Well, we're continuing on in our study series. It's a miracle. And we've been looking at the miracles of Jesus. And today we're going to look at another group of miracles. We've done that before. And as with other times, our purpose is to look at miracles that have something in common. And to see if we can learn anything new by placing them side by side. By the end of this message, we'll have looked at 18 of the miracles of Jesus over 9 studies. So, today's miracles are these. The man with an unclean spirit, the man with a wasted or withered hand, and the woman who had been bent over for 18 years. And my reason for grouping these 3 miracles together is that they were all performed on the Sabbath day. But I hear you say there were more than 3 miracles that were performed on the Sabbath day. We've already mentioned that. And you're right. For example, last week's miracle, the healing of the man at the pool of Bethesda, that was also on the Sabbath day. So why choose these 3 then? Well, not only did they happen on the Sabbath day, but they happened in the synagogue. And that makes them interesting, I think. And I think that's something that perhaps we don't often look at as something to put together and look at the 3 that were done on the Sabbath in the synagogue. One of these miracles we've already briefly mentioned in connection with another one, and that was when we looked at the miraculous deliverance of the demon-possessed man at Gadara. So we have mentioned, just in passing, the man with the unclean spirit. So we're going to look at that one again to begin with in a wee bit more detail. And we're going to use Mark's account, Mark's Gospel and chapter 1 and verse 21. Mark's Gospel, chapter 1, a reading from verse 21. And they went into Capernaum, and straightway on the Sabbath day he entered into the synagogue and taught. And they were astonished at his doctrine, for he taught them as one that had authority and not as the scribes. So very early on, the clues to Jesus' identity were beginning to appear. There was something different about this man. And what better place for that to become apparent than in the place that was set aside for the worship of God and the study of the scriptures? But, verse 23, there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit. Oh dear. Now, by describing someone as having an unclean spirit, Mark was saying that the man was possessed with an evil spirit. And that soon becomes evident as the story goes on, as you know. So, there was a man in the synagogue with an unclean spirit. And he cried out, saying, "Let us alone. What have we to do with thee, thou Jesus of Nazareth? Art thou come to destroy us? I know thee, who thou art, the Holy One of God." Now, this isn't the first time when demons have addressed Jesus in this way. And in doing so, they've revealed their prior knowledge of him, who he really is. But it's sad, isn't it, that the religious Jews in the synagogue that day, they couldn't tell that the devil was in their midst. But worse than that, they couldn't tell that the Holy One of God was in their midst. How long had that man been attending the synagogue? There certainly on this occasion was no attempt being made to bar him from worship. That makes me think of something. Think of discernment. Discernment. Even amongst the assembly of God's people. Is this a day when there's a lack of discernment? Well, surely this is a day when we should have discernment, isn't that right? And to know if something is of the Lord, to look for the clues, to know when the devil's in our midst. Because even after the outburst of this man, or even the unclean spirit that was within the man, the Jewish audience seemed to be unable and incapable of joining up the dots regarding Jesus' identity. Verse 25, Jesus rebuked them, saying, "Hold thy peace or be muzzled." And Jesus could muzzle the unclean spirit with a single command. But isn't it interesting that the devil has been trying to muzzle God's servants? And he's doing a fairly good job of it. The devil, through very subtle ways, is muzzling the Christian in the workplace today. The devil, in very subtle ways, is muzzling the Christian teacher in school today. He's muzzling the politician. He's even muzzling preachers. He's at work. He's busy. Peter says in 1 Peter 5, beginning of verse 8, "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, as a what? Roaring lion." Doesn't just say a lion or a vicious lion. This is a lion who's roaring. Because you see, the devil's making sure his message is getting out there. And boy, is the devil roaring today. What do they call a group of lions? A pride. Interesting. And what a roar the pride is making today. He's roaring, but one day the devil will be muzzled. Praise God. Well, Jesus rebukes him. "Hold your peace, be muzzled." And says to the unclean spirit, "Come out of him." And when the unclean spirit had torn him and cried with a loud voice, he came out of him. Oh boy. The devil doesn't give up easily, you know. He doesn't let go of his prey easily. Luke's account is almost the same as Mark's in this regard, with only a couple of differences. One being that Luke adds this, Luke 4 at the end of verse 35. The devil came out of the man and the man wasn't hurt. So even though the devil, in being sent from possessing that man, he didn't give up without one last final tossing of that man. But Jesus was delivering the man, and the man wasn't hurt. You know, one of the lies of Satan is that Jesus will hurt us. Becoming a follower of Jesus will damage us. Do you know the reality? The devil is the damager. The devil is the one who hurts. He's the wicked one, but Jesus is the one who heals. What a Savior we have. One final exhibition of the power of darkness was irresistible to that old spirit that day, but Jesus said, "Go," and go he must, and he did. And all were amazed, verse 27 of Mark 1, insomuch that they questioned among themselves, saying, "What thing is this? What new doctrine is this? For with authority commandeth he even the unclean spirits, and they do obey him." Yes, they were amazed. Yes, they wondered. But Mark doesn't go on to say something that we would like to see there. He doesn't say that they believed. Remember how Jesus would go on later to rebuke the town of Capernaum. And he would compare them to places like Tyre and Sidon, where miracles like this didn't happen. And he said, "You didn't believe. How much worse, how much sorer it will be for you in the judgment than for them." Yes, they wondered at Jesus, but they didn't believe. Verse 28, however, this happened, word gets round, and his fame immediately spread abroad throughout all the region round about Galilee. Now, it's interesting that in these early days of Jesus' ministry, there's no mention of there being a specific problem with the deliverance of a demon-possessed man in the synagogue on the Sabbath day. But that's about to change. Because let's consider another of the three miracles that we've mentioned in our introduction. And for that, we'll turn to Luke's Gospel in chapter 6, the Gospel of Luke and chapter 6. And before we get to the actual miracle, I would like to read some verses that come before it so that we get the context. So we read from verse 1 then of Luke 6. And it came to pass on the second Sabbath after the first that Jesus went through the cornfields, and his disciples plucked the ears of corn and did eat, rubbing them in their hands. Certain of the Pharisees said unto them, Why do ye that which is not lawful to do on the Sabbath days? And Jesus answering them said, Have you not read so much as this, what David did when himself wasn't hungered, and they which were with him, how he went into the house of God and did eat of the showbread, and gave also to them that were with him, which it is not lawful to eat, but for the priests alone. And he said unto them that the Son of Man is Lord also of the Sabbath. And it came to pass also on another Sabbath that he entered into the synagogue and taught. And there was a man whose right hand was withered. So there's the way that Luke intended us to read about the healing of the man with the withered hand. He emphasizes the fact that it was on the Sabbath. And he gives a little talk beforehand about how that would be important, the significance of that, what that would mean. So the two are together, and that's why I've said at the beginning of this series, we so often just use these miracles in a gospel context and don't take time to maybe look at them and how they were first written in the first place. Luke, of course, is writing to Theophilus, and he's letting him know about the importance of making this link between the discourse regarding what the disciples ate on the Sabbath day and then what was about to happen in healing on the Sabbath day. So it's the issue of the Sabbath. Things are starting to move. Things are gathering pace in the ministry of Jesus. At the end of that first reading of the first parable, the casting out of the man with the unclean spirit, just at the end of that, we read that verse which said, his fame spread abroad. So things were starting to happen. By the time we come to this account here in Luke, there were crowds who were starting to be made aware of who Jesus is and coming for healing. So something's changing. And obviously Jesus is being recognized as a teacher, as a healer, as a miracle worker. And sadly, the popularity of Jesus isn't universally welcome. See, Jesus was unique. He was the real thing so far as God being man was concerned, and as far as a man keeping the law was concerned, and doing it in the right spirit. As far as all that was concerned, Jesus was unique because nobody else had ever done that perfectly or sinlessly, but he did. He showed up all the hypocrisy and falseness of the ultra-religious Jews of his day simply by being him. And here's the problem. They couldn't cope with it. They couldn't deal with it. You see, they wanted him to be like them or worse than them. We can always find somebody in life, can't we, who's worse than us. You know, maybe we have a day when we think that we haven't done so well, whether it be with regard to our spiritual walk with the Lord or in some other measure, maybe haven't done so well. But we can soon look around you and you'll find a dozen more people who've done even worse. The religious elite in Jesus' day would have been so glad that Jesus was just like them, or even worse. In fact, as time went on, they wanted him to be worse than them, because they couldn't cope with the fact that amongst them was the example of perfect holiness in the person of Jesus. So instead of looking to him to get help from him so that they might walk a better path, so that they might be on the right way to right living, their preferred option was to do a character assassination on Jesus. To look for the flaws. to expose him and destroy his reputation, allowing them to get their own legalistic form of godliness accepted. They thought on this occasion that they had him because he's breaking the Sabbath. Well, we mentioned a wee bit about this last time regarding the man at the pool of Bethesda, because remember Jesus said, take up your mat. Carry something on the Sabbath day. See, alongside the law of God, there was Jewish tradition. It was certainly, by this stage, a written text defining God's law in a very legalistic and unspiritual way. In fact, it just created more of a burden for the people. And according to the traditions that were added, the disciples had broken two of the rules on that particular Sabbath that we read about, where they walked through the fields. They harvested a crop, because just to pull the ears off the grain was enough to be classed as harvesting a crop. But they did worse than that. They processed it, because they rubbed it in their hands. They did the job that would otherwise be done en masse in winnowing or threshing. Tut, tut. Now, obviously, this is extreme by any standards, but here's something. Legalism is extreme. Legalism is extreme. It loses sight of the spiritual object of the scriptural command, and it turns that command into a rule. And to the carnal mind, to make something even harder to keep and more difficult to obey, or to make it able to be obeyed in the flesh, seemed to be something that they aimed for. But look at Jesus' answer when he heard that the disciples were being challenged by the Pharisees. Luke 6 and 3, Jesus answered and said, have you not read what David did when he was hungry? And those that were with him, he went into the house of God and took the showbread and gave it to them that were with him. And it was only the priests who could do that when they changed over the showbread. Matthew adds this when Matthew gives the account of this miracle in Matthew 12. And in verse 5 we read this from Matthew's Gospel. Have you not read in the law how that on Sabbath days the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless? But I say unto you that in this place is one greater than the temple. But if ye had known what this meaneth, I will have mercy and not sacrifice, ye would not have condemned the guiltless. For the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath day. So, before we even get to the healing of the person with the withered hand, here we have examples of a hungry king and his soldiers. The king from whom Jesus is descended. But then there's also the example of serving priests, doing God's work every day of the week, including the Sabbath. And yet by so doing, they are not offending God. And of course, as Jesus came into this world, he was born king. He was of the line of David, we know that. And he is God's perfect servant. All of these things should have been obvious if they had known their scriptures, but of course they weren't thinking that way. And Jesus lets them see that there's no way that he could be breaking the Sabbath if only they knew who he was. He's Lord of the Sabbath. And in Matthew's account, if he had known this, what this meaneth, I will have mercy and not sacrifice, he would not have condemned the guiltless. And that's a quotation from Hosea 6 and 6, where it reads in full like this, for I desired mercy and not sacrifice, and the knowledge of God more than burnt offerings. Now, why would Jesus quote that? Why would he direct them to that passage? Well, here's what Hebrews 1 and 1 reads from the NASB. God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets in many portions and in many ways, in these last days has spoken to us in his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the world, and he, that is Jesus, is the radiance of his glory and the exact representation of his nature, and upholds all things by the word of his power. So Jesus is making the point that on focusing on the letter of the law, as these religious Jews were doing, they were missing the bigger picture, which was, on that occasion, the wonder of God's Son, God the Son, being in their very midst. In their midst was the exact representation of God's nature. And if they had known anything about what Hosea was writing, they would have realized that they should have been more interested in being filled with the knowledge of him through his revelation. And his greatest revelation is Jesus. The best route to fuller knowledge of God would have been for them to look at Jesus, and not to close their eyes to his glory by burying themselves in man-made tradition. So with all that said, and with the Pharisees defiantly refusing even to consider Jesus' words, this happens. Luke 6 and 6. And it came to pass also on another Sabbath that he entered into the synagogue and taught. And there was a man whose right hand was withered. And the scribes and Pharisees watched him. And that's because of what happened before. They watched him whether he would heal on the Sabbath day, that they might find an accusation against him. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all mention the fact that the Pharisees wanted to be able to accuse Jesus of something. And Mark and Luke specifically state that they watched Jesus like a hawk to see if he would notice this disabled man and then proceed to heal him in the synagogue on the Sabbath day. Now, as you know, I like to try, when I read through these accounts, to imagine myself there, to try and visualize this. And in doing so, I imagine the disabled man turning up at the door of the synagogue on that particular Sabbath. Instead of being shown to his normal spot, he's encouraged by the leaders to take a more prominent place, where it would be hard to miss him. And in tandem with this, the rulers of the synagogue would position themselves in such a way that they could see both the man and Jesus. A kind of set up. Because they wanted to accuse him. They had that in their heart. They went with that aim. And they wanted to destroy his character and his reputation. Here's the wonderful thing. Jesus has nothing to fear from the accusations of men or the devil. Jesus says in John 14 and 30, the prince of this world, that's his title for the devil, comes, but he has nothing in me. He can find nothing. Now the same prince of this world is the accuser of the brethren, and he can find plenty wrong with the brethren, but not in him. Whatever he accuses Jesus of, or whatever his servants or his followers accuse Jesus of, is groundless. Look at how many false accusations against Jesus right up until his crucifixion backfired. Even Pilate himself didn't agree with the accusations that were being made against him, and yet Jesus was crucified. However, verse 8 of Luke 6, he knew their thoughts. You know your thoughts here this morning? I don't. There's been many a time I sat in a meeting and listened to a preacher and I thought they did know my thoughts because they did say things that were very appropriate and were right on the mark. That's a work of the Holy Spirit, by the way. But Jesus knows your thoughts. The Holy Spirit knows your thoughts. God knows your thoughts. He knows you're down sitting and you're uprising, is acquainted with all your ways. He knew their thoughts and said to the man which had the withered hand, rise up and stand forth in the midst. And they arose and stood forth. Then said Jesus unto them, now he knows their thoughts, so he addresses them. I will ask you one thing. Is it lawful on Sabbath days to do good or to do evil, to save life or to destroy it? And looking round about upon them all, he said unto the man, stretch forth thy hand. And he did so, and his hand was restored whole as the other. And they were filled with madness, and communed one with another what they might do to Jesus. They didn't like the fact that, number one, Jesus went on to do what he could do in healing, and what they were hoping he would do in healing, but they didn't expect that he would say what he said, because I don't think they realized that he could read their thoughts, because they didn't accept that he was God. So in spite of all these attitudes being present, here's the thing. Jesus, even though he knew all that was going on, he still had compassion on the man and healed him. He asked him to get up, come forward, and stretch out the hand that didn't work. Again, I try to imagine that. This disabled man has entered the synagogue. He has one good hand that's useful, but the other is no use to him. I wonder how many times he came and went from the house of God. Exactly unchanged. I wonder how many times maybe somebody here has come and gone from the house of God unchanged in heart. All the records say that one hand was previously useless, but when it was restored, it was as good as, it was like the other. And from that we can safely say that there had been an obvious difference before. The contrast would have been visible. Perhaps the wasted hand had been curled and was rigid. And by Jesus saying, stretch forth your hand, didn't say stretch forth your arm, he said stretch forth your hand. He's asking him to unfurl the hand in a way that he couldn't have done so before. And now both are perfectly articulate. It's a miracle. And it happened. At the word of Jesus, he unfurls the withered hand. And to his own amazement, it functions exactly as the other did. No physio, no rehab, no OT program. Immediate. Healed. What a difference that this would have made to everyday life for this man. Now the Bible encourages us to rejoice with those who rejoice. Also says weep with those who weep. But here's what we read in verse 11 of Luke 6. They were filled with madness and communed one with another what they might do to Jesus. You see how things are shifting? The first story we looked at ended with curiosity and wonder, and many people getting to hear. But now we find, what will we do with Jesus? What will we do with the problem of Jesus? So let's look at the other miracle that happened on the Sabbath in the synagogue, and it's the woman who was bent over for 18 years. Luke's Gospel again, chapter 13. Luke chapter 13, we read from verse 10. And Jesus was teaching in one of the synagogues on the Sabbath. And behold, there was a woman which had a spirit of infirmity 18 years and was bowed together and could in no wise lift up herself. And when Jesus saw her, he called her to him and said unto her, woman, thou art loosed from thine infirmity. He laid his hands on her, and immediately she was made straight and glorified God. From a straightened hand to a straightened body. Did anybody join this woman in glorifying God? You would have hoped so, wouldn't you? But here's what we read in verse 14 of Luke 13. The ruler of the synagogue answered with indignation because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath day and said unto the people, there are 6 days in which men ought to work. In them therefore come and be healed, but not on the Sabbath day. Notice how the ruler of the synagogue put Jesus into the same category as any other man. There are 6 days for man to work. And he's not enthusiastically or convincingly attributing this miracle to the power of God. Because if you think about it, if God had given the power, if this was a miracle of God, then that would mean that God was pleased to do this on the Sabbath day. Makes sense. It's logical. If this was of God, God could have refused to do it on the Sabbath day. He could have said, oh no, that violates the tradition of the fathers. It was of God, and God did it on the Sabbath day. So these religious phonies just did not want to be open to the fact that Emmanuel, God with us, was in their very midst. Verse 15, the Lord then answered him and said, thou hypocrite, doth not each one of you on Sabbath days loose his ox and his ass from the stall and lead them away for watering? And ought not this woman, being a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan hath bound low these 18 years, be loosed from this bond on the Sabbath day? Now it does say spirit of infirmity, and Jesus also talks about Satan having bound her, which causes some to ask, was her deformity something that needed to be exercised? Okay, this was an evil spirit, that a spirit of illness on this occasion. Well, I think there's a clue in the story itself, because when we get to how the healing is then reported, Luke doesn't mention any spirit leaving her at Jesus' command. The passage just says that she was loosed, and after Jesus touched her, she became straight. So we might say that the use of the language of the spirit of infirmity and Satan hath bound, we might say that there are many things that are the results of the curse, which is a result of the fall, including sickness and death, of course. And here's a woman who has had this illness for 18 years. And Jesus goes on to say, you're a daughter of Abraham. Now, of course, if she was truly a Jewish person, and she must have been to have been in the synagogue that day, that, well, she could say, I'm a daughter of Abraham in that regard. Biologically, I'm an ethnic daughter of Abraham. But whenever you think about what Jesus is really saying here in the context, where he's saying it, to the kind of people he's saying it, he's really saying this. You're like Abraham, you're an Abrahamite, because you wanted to glorify God when you were healed. There's faith. There's something there. As soon as you're healed, you know what to do. And that is to glorify God. Remember, Jesus said this in John chapter 8 from verse 32. You shall know the truth. The truth shall make you free. And then verse 39, they answered and said unto him, Abraham is our father. So these are very religious Jewish people here saying this. But Jesus said unto them, if ye were Abraham's children, so they were biologically and ethnically Abraham's. But he said, if you were Abraham's children, you would do the works of Abraham. Now that's something else, isn't it? That's being like Abraham in his faith and belief and his desire to glorify God, to react to God correctly. Verse 41 of John 8, you do the deeds of your father. They said to him, but we are not born of fornication. We have one father who's even God. But Jesus said, if God were your father, you would love me. For I proceed forth from God. Neither came I of myself, but he sent me. Why do you not understand my speech? Even because you cannot hear my word, you're of your father the devil, and the lust of your father you will do. He was a murderer from the beginning, and abode not in the truth, because there is no truth in him. When he speaketh a lie, he speaketh of his own, for he is a liar and the father of it. But because I tell you the truth, you believe me not. So this woman was a daughter of Abraham in every sense. She glorified God. Jesus is exposing the unspiritual hearts of this ultra-religious group in the synagogue on the Sabbath day. Do you know they thought more of their livestock than they did of souls? They did of a woman with need. They thought more of their additional traditions, what they have added to the law and how they have interpreted the law carnally and legalistically. They thought more of that than of a needy soul in their midst. Oh, may we never end up like that. And then there's the woman herself. Because in spite of her deformity, she made it to the synagogue. I love that. Because I'm looking down on this audience and I know a number of people here. And in spite of the number of diagnoses that some of you have, you've made it here today. And that touches my heart. You're here. And there are many others who perhaps have less to concern them and they're not here. That woman got to the synagogue that day, not knowing what lay ahead of her. You don't want to miss out, do you? And she knew her first duty when she was healed, to glorify God. This is what Luke writes in verse 17 of chapter 13. And when he had said these things, all his adversaries were ashamed, and all the people rejoiced for all the glorious things that were done by him. Three miracles performed on the Sabbath day in the synagogue. One early on in Jesus' ministry, which left the onlookers amazed and wondering. But as time goes on, we see a hardening. We see a rejection. And eventually, Jesus is a stranger in the synagogue. Oh, may he find in us people who can discern the presence of evil, but also the presence of the Master. May he find in us people who have a love for the shackled and bound, more than a love of tradition. May he find in us people who believe him and people who want to glorify him when we see him at work. May he find in us people who know him. I desired mercy, not sacrifice. It's not about how much we can do, how faithful we can be, how much we can give. I desired mercy, not sacrifice, and the knowledge of God. Do we know him? Do we really know him? May he find in us people who rejoice when we see God at work and setting people free. May the Lord bless these thoughts to our hearts for his name's sake.